Welcome back. Michael Warren Thomas sits Naturally Green, and this morning and this afternoon, from 10 to 2, there'll be a special guest at the Birdhouse who's going to be signing books of Arthur Singer's The Wildlife Art of an American Master, and we have one of his sons with us right now, Alan Singer, who will be there starting at 10 until 2 today at the Birdhouse, so you can meet him and see this book that is fairly new. You and your brother Paul worked on this for a number of years to get this book out, right?
We certainly did, and thank you, Michael, for coming and doing this interview. We're looking forward to seeing people at the Birdhouse this Saturday, June 2nd, and we'll be doing a presentation also at 11, and that's a talk that I like to give in support of our new book. We walk our audience through my father's life and career, and we talk about his artwork, and we talk a little bit about the process of putting this book together, which did take at least a couple of years. That is myself and my brother, Paul.
Yeah. And did he only illustrate birds, or is that just a feature of this book that you've put together?
Well, since we are talking at the Birdhouse, we're going to be talking mostly about birds. And that was my father's major love, but it was no means his only thing that he did. He started actually at the Bronx Zoo drawing and painting birds when he was maybe 12 years old. He lived in New York City, so the only other birds that he might have seen would have been pigeons on the street. So I think that he got started with local birds and then graduated to the tropics. He loved being in the tropics. And then he started to work on Birds of the World, which ended up being a major publication put out by Golden Books in the 1960s.
He sort of worked through the golden age of illustration, wasn't it? Amazing work that these artists were doing.
Yes, my father was part of a large group who graduated from the Cooper Union in New York City. So his friends were artists, and I would say, yes, it was a golden age of illustration. My father certainly contributed to that. He was a part of that and supported that, and I would say that, you know, he didn't invent bird illustration. I really could give credit to Audubon and even folks earlier than that. And so my father really followed in the footsteps of Audubon. But yet he created something of his own that was very, very useful, I think. Through his publications, a lot of folks found out about nature. And I think also it came along at a period of time with Silent Spring and Rachel Carson's book, that awareness of conservation and our environment started to become popularized.
So did he travel to where these birds were? How did he illustrating, because many of them are tropical and from all over the world?
Well, I remember my father took us out to the state parks, and then we traveled all over the United States looking at birds, and then gradually he took the family to the tropics, and we looked at birds in Trinidad and Tobago, for example. And then, you know, he also went on safaris to Africa. And then he was in the Middle East, and so he got around. I didn't go everywhere with him, but he really did bring his family with him most of the time.
You still have his passport of all the places he went to?
Well, actually, in doing research for our new book, The Wildlife Art of an American Master, we came across many, many diaries that he kept and letters that he wrote home about what he was seeing, including vast flocks of flamingos in Lake Magadi in Kenya. So, I mean, he was sending messages home for sure, but he also did keep track of a lot of his travels.
So as an illustrator who's trying to paint the finest detail of the birds, really, it seems to be incredibly accurate. Is he, you know, binoculars and how do you get close enough to these birds to see these details he's able to paint?
Well, you know, as I said, he got started at the Bronx Zoo. So let's say he got started with birds that were in cages, that were close up, and he drew them. So he would draw from life. And I would say that he drew from life for most of his career, but he was also an avid photographer. And we have upstairs now hundreds of thousands of slides. And so he took photographs wherever he went, and he had long lens cameras. And so it was a combination of what he could draw for himself, what he could photograph, what he would see in, through binoculars. And also he was a book collector. So he had other artists' interpretations of those birds of the world that he was interested in. And you put it all together and you can say pretty much that they're accurate. And on top of that, he also would visit the Museum of Natural History in New York City to go up on the floor dedicated to ornithology and study the bird skins. These are stuffed birds that they had by the thousands at the museum. So he was actually looking at the real thing, even though it was dead.
But you know, part of the research of getting this right, and but also not just the birds, he had to be able to draw a little bit of their habitat, right? This was the correct plants. They you can't have a cardinal flying around with tropical palm trees. But so his illustrations are much broader than just birds, really.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. The accuracy of his work extended to the environments. And since I watched him work, he worked at home, I became aware of the style that he was working within, and I also kind of perfected my own ability to work alongside him and actually contribute to some of his artwork. I did many of the backgrounds in his last 10 years of work in his career, because he had so much work to do that he couldn't possibly handle it all as an individual. So, and we actually collaborated on things like the state bird and flower stamps.
I was going to ask you where people might have seen his illustrations, what publications in the past, and then the stamps also.
Yeah, well, my father, as I said, got started in the 1960s. He had his artwork published by American Home magazine, and these were for prints that you could take out of the magazine and hang up on your wall. And they would come along with each issue of the magazine for a couple of years. That happened. And then he was awarded a contract through Golden Books to do the book Birds of the World, which we mentioned before. And then also the very popular Golden Guides. These are guidebooks to birds of North America and then birds of Europe. And he did Birds of the Holy Land and Birds of South America with James Bond. He did... the real James Bond was a bird watcher.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Ian Fleming, who wrote the James Bond books, was also a bird watcher. And he wrote the first few volumes of the James Bond thrillers, I think in Jamaica, where he used the book by the real James Bond. His name is Terrence James Bond, and he was a bird painter. And so Ian Fleming would use that bird guide, and my father happened to have been one of the artists in that book as well. So,
do you ever try to imagine how many people have been exposed to his illustrations over these decades? Millions, probably.
Yeah, there are millions of my father's books in print. By the end of his career, he had illustrated 20 books. And some of these books take years to do. The Birds of the World was a 5-year project.
There's a lot of birds in the world.
That's right. It's over 700 families of birds. And then Birds of North America was at least 2.5 years project. And then Birds of Europe came afterwards. So he was involved with birds for many years, but it was not the only thing. I know you asked me whether birds were his only interest, but he also illustrated books on dogs, on cats, on animals of the zoo. So I would say he had a wide range of interests as far as his illustrations go. And then I also remember he would take his paints with him on those vacations that we went with him, and he would paint the landscape. So, you talked about the backgrounds being accurate. He also painted wherever he traveled. So if you happen to have seen our exhibition that we had at the University Gallery at RIT last summer, we included some of his plein air paintings that he did directly from places that he would inhabit.
So the what was the genesis of the new book that you've put together to look back on his life, his style, kind of pull all of that together?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I think what was coming up was a 25-year anniversary since my father had passed away. And my brother and I both felt that if we were going to do something, we better do it now while we were still, you know, kind of aware and we had opportunities to work on this together. So my brother would and I would exchange, you know, chapters. We would both work on the research. We would both work on developing the imagery and getting permissions, mostly from the publishers who had already printed my father's work. And getting the permissions is actually the hard part of putting a book together. Right.
Because how many illustrations in there? Probably hundreds.
Yes, that's right. But it's just a little tip of the iceberg of all of the artwork that my father published during his life. So, yeah, putting the book together is a labor of love. I'm glad to have worked on it with my brother. I think our writing styles were very, very similar. So once again, we could dovetail the work that we did. And we also had great help from the editors and designers at RIT Press that published our book. So I would say all in all, it's a team effort.
Alan Singer's with us, and he'll be at the Birdhouse today from 10 to 2. You can get a copy of this book, have him sign it. You can talk to him about birds, about his own artwork, and we'll get into your work as an artist because you're a professor at RIT. But is your brother Paul also an artist? Did he follow in your father's footsteps too?
Yeah, my brother's 4 years older than I, and if you've taken a walk along the Erie Canal, you've probably seen the work that my brother has done because he's been involved in doing the graphics that explain what you're seeing along the canal, literally from Lockport all the way over to Albany. So he's been involved in the Erie Canal historical project for many years. He's also doing we call it graphics I guess they're kind of informational graphics that you would find in parks and places all the way out to California and up north here, especially in the industrial areas. He does a writing as well, and he's interested in history. So I would say my brother and I have shared a lot of visual arts pursuits, and he's an artist and a graphic designer.
And what do you teach at RIT? And give us some background on after working with your father, doing the backgrounds when you're much younger. What's your career been like?
Well, I've also been exhibiting my work, probably since I was in my early 20s. I lived in New York City, so I was involved in the art gallery scene for many, many years, and now I'm involved in the art gallery scene here in the Rochester area. I'll be having a show in the wintertime at the Axum Gallery. Right now I'm having artwork up at Oxford Gallery. That's part of a show called Ode to Joy. So I think that's a group show with about 62 artists in it. So it's a big, big show at the Oxford. I have a print there called Comprehension.
And that goes through June 16th at the Oxford Gallery. And then you just had a show and did a talk at the Memorial Art Gallery. And as you said, RIT also had one earlier. That was with your father's work. How has your artwork, then what you do, how has that changed and grown out of your father's, I guess?
Well, I have to also give credit to my mom, who was also an artist and a gardener. And so I think one of the things that I first started to do was paint portraits of the plants in our garden. And actually that led into a book on houseplants that I published in the mid-1970s. And today I actually teach a class called Zoological and Botanical Art at RIT, where I've been a professor for close to 30 years. So I teach design, I teach illustration, I teach fine art.
And it seems from shows that I've seen, including Philadelphia Flower Show, but also things around here, that people are kind of rediscovering botanical art. And it, you know, maybe like vinyl records, too. They see what it can bring that maybe photographs can't.
Oh, you're absolutely right about the interest in botanical art. I think it started when a group of folks, while I was in New York City, started the American Society of Botanical Artists. And they were there to promote their work, along with the Guild of Natural Science Illustrators. Both of these are groups, big groups of artists that sponsor shows and I think make public more aware of this branch. It's a branch of art that's really, tied to science. And while it hasn't been like a major hit like Impressionism, it certainly is very, very big in Great Britain, where I think interest in horticulture has always been a priority. But here in the United States, people are beginning to notice what we're doing. And I'm very happy to be a part of that.
Well, and maybe you see it reflected in your students and what they want to do, and as they see some interest growing in that area, can the general public take courses like this with you, or is it just for matriculated RIT undergraduates?
Well, I guess you could, always come in and speak to me. People sometimes just go and, listen in on a class. I think you could do that as an outsider, as long as I know that you're, interested. But there are a lot of folks in RIT that take my class for credit and then go out in the field and actually make a living doing this type of art. So whether it's birds or whether it's flowers, there's a huge audience for it. I think they estimated there are 40 million bird watchers in the country. Many of them buy bird books. There are many more horticulturists and home gardeners that also purchased my books in the past. So I would say that, this is a big audience, and maybe it's beginning to be better represented by folks such as my students.
And really, if we're going to preserve this planet, we need to connect not only our generations, but the younger generations that are coming up with nature, and encouraging kids to draw that bug, or just don't worry whether it looks like it, just draw it, and the physicalness of actually drawing on paper rather than on a computer has its own benefits.
Yeah, and actually, you bring up a good point. I actually have a student who is actually two students who won internships, and they're actually going down to the Smithsonian this summer to draw and paint, maybe bugs, So, and once you bring people's attention to nature and see how the people see how beautiful it is, then they have ownership and they want to try to preserve it. So I think once you make people aware of what's out there and they begin to differentiate and see what's out there, then they want to save it, for their children and their children's children. So there's something to that. Yeah, the whole environmental consciousness is something that I do treasure, as part of my class, and I'm raising people's awareness of what's out there. And we get started literally with plants that I bring right into the class, and they're sitting in front of the plants. Or we have a group like Wild Wings that brings in birds right into my classroom so that students can study them from only a few feet away, which we do literally every year.
Amazing to see the owls and hawks up that close rather than through binoculars. And I interviewed Dick Kane, who's a longtime Rochester artist and sort of landscape artist. And it really seems like when you try to draw something, not always, but usually it forces you to see the finer details that a lot of people just miss because they're not looking as carefully. And that includes the shadows, the textures, all of these things that you don't need to be a professional artist and be able to replicate them, but just by the effort of trying, you see things more deeply. You see the detail, and the maybe the little tiny bugs that you never noticed that are on that plant that you're trying to draw.
Well, what you're saying is absolutely true, Michael. When you're drawing something by hand, it becomes a physical part of you. It becomes part of your body. It leaves an impression that would be very, very different than if you were just taking a photograph of it or trying to use a computer to draw it. Now, it's true that a lot of my students at RIT are technologically savvy, and many of them do their work on the computer. But I have them start off literally with a pencil and paper, drawing what they see that way by hand, because as I say, when you draw something by hand, you in a way own it. It becomes a part of you, and it becomes part of your memory system. And I think once you get started, you also look more deeply at detail rather than just looking at a photograph, maybe which you took or somebody else took, and you don't really see or stop to see the detail as if you were trying to draw it yourself. I think when you see it yourself and draw it yourself, you're seeing more deeply and more. It's more satisfying, I think, than leaving it up to a computer.
And I was down at the Brandywine River Museum, N.C. Wyeth's his illustrations, and it's some from his family. And I didn't realize how big they were. The original paintings are huge, 4 feet by 6 feet, some of them. And we just see them in the little Robinson Crusoe books or something. But the illustrations that your father did for that are in the Wildlife Art of American Master, this new book, are the originals this size, or are they much bigger? And what medium did he use to paint?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, my father took after Audubon. Now, Audubon, if you've seen any of his original artwork, he said that he would try to paint birds life-size. Now, the original Audubons are in the New York Historical Society right across the street from the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. So my father would walk across the street and see the original Audubons. I don't know how Audubon actually succeeded at doing what he did, because he painted every bird in the United States that he could find. And my father has painted many of the birds in the United States too, but he didn't have the time to paint the birds life size. So I would say it's a toss-up. Some of the birds that he's done during my father's career, he passed away in 1990, were painted life size, but they only came later in his career. Early in his career, most of the paintings were illustrations for books, and they were not nearly as large as the birds themselves, which would have been too time-consuming to try to achieve.
And what medium did he use for these the illustrations?
Well, my father's preferred medium was watercolor or gouache. Gouache is a opaque watercolor. And so my father would use these little tiny brushes. They call them zeros or number ones or twos, little fine sable hair brushes to get a perfect point. And he would use those brushes to delineate all the finest details, like we're looking at these hummingbirds right here on the cover of our new book. And one of the most difficult things is to portray iridescence, which hummingbirds have as part of their feathering. Very, very difficult to try to show something that's reflective or shiny. But yet my father, I think, achieved that look in his illustrations. So he's using watercolor. It's fairly time-consuming. I would say I watched my father work since he worked at home, and to draw and paint each bird is hours of work for each bird. So you're looking at the sum total of literally thousands and thousands of hours of work.
Well, extraordinary to see these birds up close, and it hopefully will inspire maybe people who aren't bird watchers to go try and find some of these around our area, elsewhere around the world.
Well, you know, get your bird feeders at the birdhouse, because they have bird seed and they have all the things that'll attract, you know, birds to your backyard. And I think that's the way we began as children of Arthur and Judy Singer. And that was looking at the birds that would be attracted to the bird feeder in our backyard. So the hummingbirds came later, but the cardinals and the blue jays and the starlings came first. So you try it. You'll enjoy it.
Yeah, the robins are on their nests right now as we speak. It's a great time now to get out. And we have in our area maybe more birding resources than a lot of parts of the country. This is a great migration route. We have the Braddock Bay Research Center and then that deals with songbirds. And then there's a raptors research center there too. So Rochester has, and then Montezuma National Wildlife Refuge. But it seems like this is a great area for birds.
And the Rochester Museum and Science Center has study collections. As you mentioned, we are on a flyway. So these are birds who are migrating up into Canada, and you can see all kinds of hawks fly. But then there are also beautiful tropical birds like tanagers, which are kind of rare, but they fly through this area because they're going north. So you have to keep your eyes open for them. And there are also study centers. We found a new place, which you may not know about, the American Museum of Bird Art in Massachusetts. We were just there because we brought my father's books there for a book signing, and we had a little show. So if you're ever near Boston, it's 20 minutes southwest of Boston, is the American Museum of Bird Art.
On the way to Cape Cod, probably. Yeah, a good stop. Well, Alan, thank you very much for your time. And today, from 10 till 2, Alan will be at the birdhouse and have copies of the book. He and his brother published maybe 2 years ago now, Arthur Singer, The Wildlife Art of an American Master. RIT Press published this, and it's gorgeous. So thank you, Alan.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thanks for this interview, and hope to see folks at the birdhouse.